lesson.
So I'd like for today to be a bit of a summing up of what we've done recently. And there will be a little bit of new information, but kind of just to round off and to polish. And so we're going to be sticking with the trajectory of the mornings and coming back to those two extremely pithy instructions from Dujum Lingpa, or Padmasambhava in the Vajra, Sharp Vajra of Conscious Awareness Tantra. Again, just to read them, they're so short. Examine the body, speech, and mind, and among them recognize the one that is primary as the all-creating sovereign. He does say, examine the one that is primary, rather than saying, examine the one that is existent versus those that are not existent. To say that the mind is primary, in fact, doesn't mean that it's any more real than anything else. There's primary and derivative. That shows the emphasis on importance, but it doesn't give a higher ontological status. It doesn't say it's more real. Okay? So that's kind of important. It turns out to be very important. Because as we see where the direction we're going here is not a topic that I'm going to elaborate a little bit on this afternoon, and that is what in the Western tradition is called subjective idealism, that the mind alone is real, or chittamatra, the mind is only real. The mind alone is real, and the objective physical universe doesn't exist at all. Okay, that's fine if you're a subjective idealist. That's chittamatra, and as we'll see this afternoon, that's Bishop George Berkeley, very, very astute philosopher. But that's not where we're going. We're setting it up, as I mentioned before and really elaborated, putting all the primacy on the mind as if we're going to completely discount the objective physical world. And then we turn out and turn that same torpedo in upon the mind to see that it is equally empty, right? It's a very cunning strategy, really. And so rather than trying to be balanced all the way through, I've often commented in our individual, you know, meetings that the way to find the middle way is not to find the middle way and follow it. It's to find the extremes and do what's left. Bounce off the extremes, keep and bounce off them less and less, and what's left is the middle way. It's hard with an imbalanced mind to say, oh, I'll simply choose balance, thank you, and go for it, you know? And that's all the way through, laxity and excitation and so on, you know? It's really smart strategy. So we've, you know, in our modern world, we've really explored excitation. We really know what that's like. And then we also know what it's like to be totally drained and stressed out and falling into a torpor and stupor. So we've, in the modern world, we've explored the two extremes very well. And now we need to find out what's left. Right. And so there it is, that one. But the next one is what I want to really focus in on again, only as a summary. And that is the shape and color of the all-creating sovereign, now that we've seen which one's primary, of course, the mind, as well as its origin, location, and destination are objectless openness. Now the point here is not to go to nihilism. That is, with the first one, it can certainly look like you're making a beeline to subjective idealism and completely dismissing the objective physical world of atoms, right? And then this one could look like you're trying to find that the mind doesn't exist. Why? Because the mind has no origin, the mind has no location, the mind has no destination, and therefore you first dismiss the physical world, and then you dismiss the subjective world, and you wind up with complete even-handed nihilism, right? He's not doing that. That's what people who don't understand Madhyamaka, when they're viewing it from outside, the Theravadins sometimes refer to Nagarjuna as a Shunyavadin, an advocate of vacuity, advocate of nothing, of sheer emptiness, as in, really, a nihilist. And I understand. If you don't get it, that's what it really looks like. Or it looks like completely hippieville, like just reality is whatever you say, man. You know, whatever you say, you know, and pass the joint, because I'm going to come up with a new reality momentarily. Just make it up as you go, you know. And so it's not that, of course, but it's not what seems to be really sober and stern and hard, and that is metaphysical realism, like there's a real world out there and deal with it. It's neither one of those. It's neither the hippie nor the stern father. Something in between. Ta-da! So when we engage in that meditation, granted we only did it once, but I gave you a whole weekend, really, you know, to identify the empty nature of the mind. Okay, a day and a half, but that should be enough, you know, if you're of sharp faculties, that should be enough. The natural question is, did I get it right? You know? What did he mean, my mind? Did I get it right? Is it awareness? Is that right? Mm-hmm. You basically want to say, you know, I did the quiz. How did I do? Is it awareness? Is it the space of the mind? I had this good feeling. Was that it? What we're trying to find out is, you know, what did Dujum Lingpa have in mind, or Padmasambhava, because really it's just straight from Padmasambhava. What did Padmasambhava have in mind when he said the mind has no shape and color, it has no location, no origin, location, or destiny? What did he have in mind? As if Padmasambhava is the one that has the problem. Padmasambhava doesn't have the problem. We don't need to worry about what Padmasambhava had in mind when he said the mind. We don't need to figure out, we can't understand Padmasambhava's mind, and therefore we don't need to figure out whether his mind is empty of origin or not. That's his problem. But he doesn't have a problem, so he has no problem. This is the real issue here. And that is, and it's very personal, so don't ask me. If there are 50 people in the room, or 500 or 5,000, whatever, listening by podcast, the wee podders, you know, or the wee pods, and we should really have, you know, like they speak of a whole group of whales as a pod of whales. Now we have a pod of meditators. I like that better, you know, than a herd or a flock. We have a pod of meditators, yeah. So in any case, moving on, if we have a pod of meditators here, 50 people, then there are 50 right answers. Because the right answer is, when you think my mind is anything, good, bad, crazy, agitated, wise, smart, creative, stupid, and so forth and so on, what comes to mind when you think my mind? Because you do think my mind a lot, and I'll bet you you're reifying it. If you're not, then you have no problem, right? And so when you think my mind, and you think of your mind, you conceive of your mind as something that's really there, something that has causal efficacy, something that was already there before you thought about it, before you labeled it, it was already waiting. And you just happened to label it my mind, but it was already there. That's the mind we're looking for. And that mind, he's saying, now that you have identified the object to be refuted from the perspective of a person who is an Arya, recognize that that mind, this real mind, this inherently existent mind, didn't come from anywhere, isn't located anywhere, and doesn't go anywhere. And that's because it isn't at all. So that's the point there. The right answer is what you come up with in terms of your concepts. And so if Amy's concept of her mind and Jose's concept of her mind are different, that's fine, because you should be critiquing, examining, investigating the referent of your sense of having a mind and not somebody else's, and trying to understand Padmasambhava's mind. Forget about it. You're not up to it. Nor am I, of course. And so those two lines, right? This is shorter than the Buddha's instructions to Bahia. That went on for a whole paragraph, right? This is two lines. So Bahia, at the end of the Dharma talk, which was a paragraph, he became an arhat. He's saying those two lines, this is the spontaneous actualization of the essential nature of the path of cutting through. What he's saying here is that if, and he says it later, this is not interpretation or speculation, it's straight from the text, and that is, if you are a person of sharp faculties, you will have already cut through with those two lines to pristine awareness. So, congratulations, now just rest. Yeah, good. Now, really, you can just rest for the next 6 weeks, because nothing that I have to say here is really, it's going to be more of a distraction than anything else. Now that you've cut through to Rigpa, your practice is very simple. It's called Buddhahood without meditation. Don't do anything. Don't listen to Alan. Don't ask any questions. Don't show up for interviews. Just write me a little note. I'm fine. I'm resting in Rigpa. Thanks a million. See you in 6 weeks. You're welcome. And you can say thank you, too. That's a person of sharp faculties. It's called spontaneous individual. Simultaneous individual. You hear the teachings and you gain realization. Bahia was simultaneous to become an arhat. He heard the teachings, bang, he became an arhat. So if you're a simultaneous individual, you're finished, just rest in rikpa. And that's your practice, really, indefinitely, until you're completely a vidyadhara. Okay? But if you didn't, I can read him again if you like. But if that still doesn't work, then he gives a further instruction for people of middling faculties. So if you didn't make the grade, if you're not a person of sharp faculties, then you might be a person of middling faculties. You know, mediocre, kumsi kumsa, like that. So as he says, simultaneous individuals enter the path with no basis and no root. They just go right in. They're already there. Okay, no basis, no root, no reification. Others, now this is people of medium faculties, you know, like on the grade C, you're okay. Others should come to rest in space, and within 3 weeks they will certainly awaken and enter the path. Well, that's very short. He explains it more elaborately later, and that is, if you're a person of medium faculties, you'll do the practice we're about to do, and you'll just do that for 3 weeks. You just basically not do anything else except for this practice. And by the end of 3 weeks, if you're a person of middle faculties, then you will have cut through to Rigpa. And then once again, you can just write me a note, I'm fine. And there's just no point in listening to anything I have to say for the next 6 weeks, because you just rest in Rigpa, right? If you're middling faculties. Okay? But if you don't cut through to Rigpa in 3 weeks, then those are the class, then you're a person of inferior faculties. like me. And so those of the class of with inferior faculties, what do? They identify stillness and movement. You've heard that one before, many times. They identify stillness and movement, and by taking the mind as the path, they are led to the absolute space of pristine awareness. So nowadays, many people in the Vipassana movement, I think, are basically Bahia wannabes. They don't have any patience for shamatha or jhanas. Oh, no, that's for stupid people. And they don't really have any time for investigation. Oh, no, that's too tiresome. They just want to keep on trying to be Bahia and just in the scene, let it be just seen, let the heard just heard, and sit there like, oh, want to be marmots who want to be Bahia. They're more likely to turn out to be a marmot than Bahia, because he came in fully charged, you know? And likewise, there's Dzogchenpas, people who think they're Dzogchen practitioners. And they've got no place for shamatha. Who needs that? That's for people of lower vehicles. And all that vipassana business, all that investigation, oh, what a drag, it's so tiresome. I just rather remain in open presence. I like that. So, marmot, Vidyadhara. Depends on what you're bringing to it. Right. But if you're a person of inferior faculties, then roll up your sleeves and start cultivating ethics, of course, and then samadhi, and samadhi by way of distinguishing between stillness and movement, and take the mind as the path, achieve it, then vipassana, and achieve it, then cut it through, do that, and then, at the direct crossing over, become a Buddha in this lifetime. That's the alternate way. Okay? Oh, yeah. I love it that it can be said so simply and so concisely. So that's it. So here's the practice that you may do for 3 weeks if you like, to see whether you're a person of middling faculties. Merging the mind with space. Please find a comfortable position. But for the devotions, you probably want to stay where you are. We will practice as we've done before. Namo lin namo laman deshe dupe ku kunjo sumge ranjin la datam do tu senjen nam janju badu kyapsu chi. Namo. In the Lama, who is the embodiment of the Sugatas, of the nature of the three jewels, I, together with the beings of the six realms, take refuge until our enlightenment. Semge Ndowa Kundun Du Lama Sangye Dukne Ni Kanla Kandu Tinle Ki Ndowa Ndowa Damja O. For the sake of all beings, I generate the spirit of awakening and cultivate the realization of the Lama as Buddha. By means of enlightened activity, I shall train each being according to their needs, then I vow to liberate the world. Hum agi yuki nupcham sam belma gesa dombola Yamsen choki ngodubnye pema june shesuta Kodu kando mambu ko keki jesu datuki Jingye lapchi sheksu su guru pema siddhi om. In the northwest frontier of Odiana, in the heart of a lotus, sits the one renowned as Padmasambhava, who achieved this wondrous supreme city and is surrounded by a host of many Dakinis. Following in your footsteps, I devote myself to practice. Please come forth and bestow your blessings. Guru Pema Siddhi Hum. If you'd like to switch positions, please do so now. Settle your body, speech, and mind, and for a short time, calm the discursive mind, the conceptual mind, with mindfulness of breathing. I will venture into the main practice gradually, from the shallow end of the pool, so to speak. We'll begin in familiar terrain or familiar practice. This arousal of awareness during in-breath and the deep sense of release of letting go during out-breath. But let there just be a peripheral awareness of the rhythm of the breath, just enough to know when it's flowing in, when it's flowing out. But primarily let your awareness rest in its own place, with no object, no grasping, no striving, no doing, no modification. And as the breath flows out, noting this with just the most peripheral awareness, release your thoughts, your memories, your imagination, your desires, your emotions. Release every aspect of your mind that you can possibly release. Release it, let it dissolve into space, into an objectless openness. So that all that remains is awareness with no object, self-illuminating, self-knowing awareness. And even this, released into the open expanse of space. Without an anchor, without a basis, or a root, in other words, with no grasping. during the course of the in-breath, do not contract, do not draw in your awareness into some small space like inside your head. On the contrary, simply elevate, accentuate, sharpen up your awareness, the awareness of awareness itself. Elevate and release without an object. Elevate and release with each in and out breath. Let your awareness be still, like a boulder in the middle of a stream, facing downwards. So as you breathe out, just let the flow of thoughts, images, memories, desires, let the flow of the mind is stream, flow away and dissolve into the space of awareness without holding on to anything. And rest in awareness with no mind. Rest in the naked awareness that remains once your mind has dissolved away. With each out-breath, release the mind, release awareness itself into this open expanse. And sustaining that experience of objectless openness, accentuate this self-illuminating awareness, knowing itself. Turn up the voltage brightly, let awareness illuminate itself. And when there is no difference in the quality of your awareness, once you've released, and once you have elevated or enhanced the awareness of awareness, when there is no difference, when you've released into space and that space itself is permeated by the luminosity of awareness, and simply rest in that non-duality of luminosity and emptiness, doing nothing, expecting nothing, aspiring for nothing, without striving, without doing. Let's continue in silence. Buenas. So being still like a boulder in a stream is definitely not going with the flow of modernity. How often have we heard this? Don't just sit there, do something useful. Or if you can, don't just sit there, do something meaningful. Right? But for heaven's sake, don't just sit there. Because if you're just sitting there, then you're neither useful nor meaningful. You're kind of like a non-entity. You don't even exist. You're not even worthy of notice because you're just sitting there. Right. So the notion of being meaningful is a phrase we just don't have in English. And yet, if our being is not meaningful, then what else could be? If your core is not meaningful, then why do you think you could come from a nothing and do something in the world that's meaningful if what you're coming from is meaningless? That doesn't make any sense, does it? And so we are caught in type of mania. I think it's a mania, the mania of modernity that would have us do something at all costs, even if it's sitting on an airplane and playing solitaire on your tablet or a crossword puzzle. Do something, for heaven's sake. Anything is better than nothing. And then, of course, it's exhausting. And so when we're really exhausted, when we've done our day's work, we've proven that they were valuable, productive citizens, then we come home and we're completely wasted. And then we sit in front of the television and we either watch something that is designed to arouse anger, excitement, or surprise, fear, disgust, and contempt. Lots of entertainment appeals to those. Or desire and craving and attachment. Lots of entertainment appeals to that. And then the remaining is pretty much situation comedies or sitcoms, which just is an assault on the intelligence. They think you're so stupid, you don't even know when to laugh. And so they have canned laughter to let you know, hey, stupid, laugh now. And there is good entertainment in movies and television, but I don't think it's the majority. That's my sense. It is. There is. Some things are worth watching, for sure. So we're going against the stream here. We're tapping into inner resources rather than focusing single-mindedly on exploiting and using up non-renewable external resources, tapping into the resources of our own awareness, the source of eudaimonia. It's quite revolutionary. So every single point is three outer preliminaries, the three inner preliminaries, seeing which is primary among body, speech, and mind, and then ascertaining the emptiness of the all-creating sovereign. That's eight revolutions in a row, all in just about one paragraph. You know, or just maybe one page. Each one of them is dramatic. Each one of them is a revolution like Einstein or Newton or Galileo or Darwin. I mean, they really shift everything. Just one of those will shift you on your axis, shift you on your, not just a belief system, for heaven's sakes. Beliefs, again, are cheap. Any one of those eight is going to shift you so you're perceiving reality from a different perspective. And that's what's meant by view, drishti. Or darshana, or dawa in Tibetan, view, that your way of viewing yourself, your mind, reality as a whole, has shifted, and it's coming more and more into alignment with reality. And the really good news there is that the more we prioritize this, just see if what I'm saying is just utterly commonsensical, transparently clear, and that is the more we oriented ourselves to shifting reality, our view of reality, so that it accords with reality, the more reality rises up to meet us. And the result of that, the dividend, the benefit of that, is genuine happiness. Because genuine happiness comes from the real, whereas hedonic just comes from stimulation. So really it would make sense then, wouldn't it? That insofar as we align ourselves with Dharma, and that's all I described was simply Dharma, and that wasn't specifically Buddha Dharma versus Hindu, Christian, or what have you, But insofar as we align ourselves with Dharma, which is aligning ourselves with a way of viewing reality that accords with reality, and therefore a way of life that accords with reality, which we call ethics, reality rises up to meet us. And a sense of well-being arises from reality with no stimulation, from the depths, from reality, reality meeting reality. That seems so transparent. So really indicates to me there's only one thing to do. Practice Dharma. Enjoy your day.